Hi, and welcome to the audio edition of Mark Hummel's Harmonica Party. My name is Jeff Vargin, and Mark and I produce this series for both the audio and video audience. Please subscribe and share this podcast, and go to Mark Hummel's Harmonica Party YouTube channel to see the video version of this episode. The video version is quite different, and there are photos and video clips of the people discussed during the episode. In part one of a two-part discussion with Junior, Junior discusses getting started in the Central Valley of California and moving to San Jose, where he began playing with the Mighty Flyers, Charlie Musselwhite, George Smith, Kim Wilson, Big Mama Thornton, Luther Tucker, Canned Heat, and our very own Mark Hummel. Junior has a new CD available called Nothing to It, But to Do It. It's available on his website at juniorwatson.com. And now, here's Mark and Junior Watson.
Hi, I'm Mark Hummel, and this is Mark Hummel's Harmonica Party, and we are brought to you tonight by Seidel Harmonicas, Electrify Records, and Mountaintop Records. And I am sitting here with somebody I've known for years and years, a guitar great. He's on so many recordings and played with the top players in the blues music industry. This is Junior Watson here. And Junior is going to tell you a little bit about how he got started and some of his experiences playing, who he played with, stories about the road, and just all kinds of tall tales. So the first thing I want to ask Junior, just to get things started, you grew up in Visalia?
No, I was born in Visalia. I grew up in Tulare, next town over.
And
that's the San Joaquin Valley, Central Coast, they call it.
What was your attraction to music as a kid? I'm assuming you got into it as a child.
Well, I'm Portuguese, you know, and you know, like I was telling you earlier, that town was pretty diverse with every nationality. Everybody got along. And I had some Mexican friends that I was going to Catholic school with, Paul Trujillo and his family. And he was messing around with the guitar. He was basically just beginning. And when I heard these guys play, I said, man, I got to get me a guitar somehow. So my grandfather takes me to White Front. That's like a...
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
That's like a Walmart back
right
then.
Right.
There was no Walmart. Right? So I bought a guitar. It cost $50 or $49.95. And the amp was like made out of cardboard. It was terrible. It was called a Rodeo guitar, right? You know, I saw the one on a... There was actually three of them on stands, you know? So I come home and it only has two strings on it. So they thought I was a genius because I figured out a song on two strings, walk right in, sit right down. Dan, dan, don, dan, 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 don, dan, don. They go, this guy's a genius. So I take the guitar over to my buddy Paul's house and he goes, man, you're missing four strings on the guitar. From that point on, it's been downhill. Just kidding. So, you know.
So they bought you the other four strings.
They bought me the other four strings finally. And then I went over to Paul, and we were messing. You know, we were trying to play surf music and stuff. But
how old were you?
14 when I first started. And then another guy that I went to Catholic school was Danny Baradat. His brother Ray was in the Charades, which is a big band, not a big band physically, but a popular
famous
band.
Yeah,
they were more like a doo-wop band. But the band, Pascal Pena, this tough-looking Mexican guy, you know, with a pompadour and the whole bit, with a strat, old beat-up strat. He was amazing. And that was like a hero to me, just that kind of R&B music, but no blues yet. And then, like I told you earlier, I found a 45 at a garage sale of Lightning Slim. That was my first introduction to hearing anything remotely with real blues. And I went, this is cool. And so didn't really start getting into finding blues because they didn't know anything about it. You know, until I moved to San Jose and listening to FM radio, underground radio, they called it. I think it was Buddy Guy. And I go, this is some cool stuff here, man. And
so was that 67 or something like that?
Yeah, I think about the beginning of 67. And then, you know, then that particular year is the first year I started going to the Fillmore.
Right.
And you see everything. And I just had to, a lot of times I'd walk out on Blue Cheer, you know. I remember sticking whole cigarettes in my ear back then. And they were so, you know,
they were my favorites.
They're in the Guinness Book of World Records.
That's the world's loudest band
in the
right
world. Man. And you know what it sounds like?
It practiced on a pier.
It just was like white noise, like this. I'm thinking, I got to get out of here.
I can do a good impression of them.
That's it. That's it. But I mean, I saw so many great things there. You know, Albert King.
I think you told me about a show one time that was Fleetwood Mac and Buddy and Freddie or something. I can't remember
Buddy played with Peter Green on one night. They had a battle like.
Remember, you told me a great lineup of those guys.
Oh, yeah. Always great. $2 to get in back then.
It's incredible, man.
Elvin Bishop called me one time and I was telling him about this. He couldn't remember this at all. How they used to make those amoeba lights, they'd offer you a handbill, $2, a ticket for the next show, or a tab of acid to sit there. They'd get like 12 people with pie plates.
Right,
and
right.
And water in there. Right. And just be going like this the whole time. And I go, not me. I came to hear music, man. I don't want to be sitting there just like a dodo going like this all the time. And then within about 3 months, they were replaced with automation.
Right. Right.
They were out of there.
No, I remember hearing about that. That's how they did the
show. That's how they did it.
Now, your mom was a singer. I remember you were telling me she was working a lot around San Jose.
Basically at one place, 17 West. Uh-huh. 18 years she was there.
And that was like a jazz, kind of a jazz club?
No, it was it was
or a lounge or what?
Standards.
Yeah, standards. So ballads and things like that.
It was a great food place, too.
Yeah. So the Fillmore was obviously a pretty big influence.
Absolutely.
In terms of opening things up to you.
But my life really changed when I met Gary Smith.
Right. And was that 68, 69?
No, I think it was actually 71. I was living right across from the bodega next to the fire station with Rob Alvarado.
That was in Campbell?
Yes.
Yeah.
I had a little alcove room where I used to come in through the window. And there was my bed, which was like a couch during the day. And so one day Rob goes, hey, you know Gary Smith? And I go, never met him, but I just saw him at the Iron Apple about 2 months ago. They sounded great. Because to me, I listened to it. I go, there's a band I'd like to get in right there. So he said, Gary's coming over. And I'm going, really? I go, do you know Gary? And he goes, no, but he's coming over. And he goes, Ed Campbell's coming over. That was our drummer.
Right.
You know, so basically, Gary came over with Robin Ford. Robin started playing. You know, he had his Super 400. He's bending over backwards in the living room. I go, what is this? What's going on here? Right? And basically, he was trying to steal our drummer.
Ah.
He was just wanting to see Ed.
Ed Campbell.
Ed Campbell had a 28-inch bass drum.
Right.
Robin left, and then Gary goes, hey, let's play something. So he goes, hey, you listen to Lockwood? And I go, never heard. Lockwood who? He goes, Robert Lockwood. I go, never heard of him. He goes, you're sliding on chords just like Lockwood. I go, never heard it. So he goes, are you hungry? This Gary's going to love this part. And I go, yeah. And he goes, you got any money? I go, I got like $6. And he goes, let's go to the store. So Gary steals a couple of eggs. We go in there and he comes out. I go, did you get anything? And he goes, let's go. So he comes back to the house and he goes, I got the 2 eggs, man. Let's eat. So he cooks them up. That was our first meeting. So he asked me, hey, man, would you like to join the band? I go, yeah, sure. So that's where I came to the 10101 house.
Right. Now, did you move right in or how'd that work out?
Pretty much so. I think I waited like a month.
Uh-huh.
And then I just went over there and never came back. Right next door was a shed that was Guitar Player Magazine. That's how we met.
Really?
That's how we met Dan Fort.
Wow. Too much.
Right next to that place was
crazy.
The original Guitar Player Magazine.
And did Dan Fort start that?
That
was he one of the? He was one of the early writers, though.
He was.
Yeah.
He was from there from the beginning.
Okay. So from what I understood about 101, it was like you and Steve Gomes, the bass player, and Gary Smith all living there.
That's right.
But everybody came apparently, over. Yeah, Musselwhite was there all the time.
It was an open
Alberto,
door.
Alberto, Gianquinte, Sid Morris. Tucker was there all the time.
All the time.
All these people were.
We used to drive Tucker.
Right.
Because he didn't drive at all.
Ever. Right. Now, was he living in the area or was
no,
he up in Marin?
He was up there in San Rafael or wherever.
Oh, he was in San Rafael.
He was living above this.
Yeah.
And his card said it was a suite, but it was above a liquor store. It was just a little shack looking thing.
Right, right.
But I mean, everybody wanted him to play with him.
Yeah. Of course.
Fenton Robinson.
Sure. Yeah.
Hooker, You know, Cotton. Even when Matt Murphy was in there, they both play together.
Right.
You know, so we just pick him up, and you know, it was an unbelievable learning experience just watching that stuff.
Just having all those guys around you.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember the first album that I got that had you on it was the Blue Bay record.
Oh, yes, 1976. Yeah.
So that was 76. And I remember Luther Tucker being on it. Skip Rose, I think, was on it.
Ron Thompson,
Muscle White. Gary Smith, you,
High Tide Harris,
Sonny Rhodes.
That's right.
Yeah,
it was a good.
It's a good record. Yeah, and it was like all you guys seemed like you were in that San Jose Bay Area scene back then.
That's right.
So yeah, I mean, you guys were really kind of the introduction, at least for me. You guys were kind of the introduction of the blues scene in the Bay Area for me.
I heard a lot of bands. Yeah. I think that's one of the best bands at that time playing blues.
You know, Gary and you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I really do.
Well, yeah. Yeah. You guys had, who was the horn player?
Kenny Baker.
Right. Kenny Baker was on a lot of gigs.
Great. Yeah.
And from what I gather, I mean, Gary was really kind of doing what I ended up doing later on, which was finding blues people and getting them gigs and setting up small tours in the Bay Area. Like he'd have like John Lee Hooker, you know, you guys would be backing him or Tucker or Mike Bloomfield, Nick Gravenitis. Yeah. You guys were kind of back. And I know at one point you guys worked with Otis Rush, right?
Oh, yeah. That was at the Great American Music Hall.
Right.
That was amazing. But all I know is he was kind of depressed and stuff, you know. And
Otis was?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he sounded amazing.
Phew. Yeah.
Got him a bassman.
Do you remember what year that was?
I think it was around 72 or 3.
Didn't you do that tour with Gary and Alberto?
Yeah.
Where you went to Lincoln, Nebraska and
here's how that
maybe
happened.
Milwaukee.
Here's how that happened. You got to back up a little bit.
Okay.
We went to Rick's Blues Bar in Venice. That was the big deal. It was a tiny little club, you know, that had a bunch of mirrors in it to make it look bigger. But they had the best jukebox I've ever heard in my life. Back in the day, back in those days, Motel 6s really cost $6.
Right, right.
But we were only making $15 a night.
Right.
And all the beer you could drink.
Yeah.
So we would flip a coin to see who's going to get, you know, because you put two people in a room. One guy got the box springs and one guy got the mattress on the floor. And I always wanted the mattress on the floor.
Right.
And 9 out of 10 times I always got that mat. But this time I got the fucking box springs. So I ended up sleeping with this girl in the back of Ed's Datsun.
Right.
Because he had a shell on the back. Right.
Right.
And I ended up getting the crabs.
Oh. That was a normal thing back then.
Oh, it was a normal thing. It was no fun, man.
Getting the clap and the crabs was just part of the 60s. If you didn't have that in the 60s and 70s, you weren't living.
That's right.
Right?
But anyway, that's where you picked Alberto up.
Wow. So you found him in LA. Well, wasn't he from San Francisco?
Yeah. He grew up on the South Side.
Was he living in LA at the time?
Kind of meandered around. Yeah. He was one of them guys that just kind of just...
Yeah, because I saw him at the Ash Grove with Charlie Musselwhite the first time. Yeah. So how did it end up being Alberto with you guys on the road? How did that come about?
We just asked him to go come with us. And at that time, every club had an upright piano or a grand piano in it.
Right.
And he'd bust those pianos up, man. He played so damn hard, you know?
Yeah. For people that don't know it, Alberto Gianquente was... the piano player that was with the first James Cotton Blues Band. He had played with, didn't he play with James Brown and B.B. King as well,
I think? B.B. King.
Yeah, B.B. King. And he was a white piano player, but he was...
Well, he wasn't white.
Well, he was
half Puerto Rican.
Half Puerto Rican, right.
Half Italian.
Right. And he ended up in James Cotton's original band, which was just a killer, killer band, with Luther Tucker on guitar, Francis Clay, Bobby Anderson. And he ended up basically getting famous because of Santana, I remember.
Well, here's the story.
The second album or something.
Santana went to school with him.
Right.
On the South Side, right? So they kind of lost track of each other. They were in Texas. And Alberto was with B.B. King playing, and Santana was headlining. And Santana's out in the audience, and Alberto sees him. And all of a sudden, he goes backstage. He goes, "Hey, brother, how you doing?" He goes, "Man, you hit the big time with B.B." He goes, "I hate it." He goes, "Why do you hate it?" He goes, "Boring. Just boring, man. I'm just get a few solos and I'm just playing, you know, it's the same stuff every night. He goes, well, come with us. And he goes, all right. So he left from Texas.
Wow.
And then then the last days of the Fillmore movie, he got $80,000.
Jeez.
Because he arranged Oyo Como Va.
Right. And he also ended up writing a song on the second album.
Yeah,
too.
I can't remember the name of it.
Incident Nesbar or something like that.
That's right.
Yep.
That's the one. Yep.
Right.
But he could play anything.
He was an amazing musician. But a heroin addict.
I learned so much from that guy.
Did you?
I really did.
Yeah.
Just about chords and music. You know?
Right.
Because he was a real musician, man.
Right, sure was.
But he got into some crazy stuff. Yeah. You know? He was a character.
He was a character. A great, great musician. You ended up leaving Gary and getting with Rod Piazza for a while. Now, did you guys meet at that Rick's Blues Bar gig?
Nope. I played one gig with Rod in 76. I think it was 78. 77 or 78.
78, you were definitely with him because I saw you guys at the Blues Festival.
Here's what happened. Gomes was playing with Rod before me.
Right.
He was coming down to L.A., backing up T-Bone and all these guys, you know, through Rod.
Right.
So all of a sudden, Rod's got this tour with George, Smokey Wilson. Let's see, who else was in the car? Johnny Dyer, Shaky Jake. Pee-wee wasn't there. That was it.
Okay.
At the Eugene Hotel.
Oh, that was up in Eugene, Oregon, yeah.
No, well, we're still, let's keep it in San Jose for a second.
Right.
So Rod goes, who can I get on this thing? And he goes, what about Watson? And he goes, who's that? He didn't even remember me.
Right.
I don't think he even knew my name when I did that first gig, right? So Gomes goes, is there any recordings of it? So he played that harmonica instrumental on Blue Bay.
Right.
Rod goes, that's all the guitar I need to hear, just rhythm.
Right.
So that's how I got that thing with Rod. And basically, I just stayed
right
at that point. And Gomes was in there for the first year. And we were going up to Bend, Oregon and stuff with George.
Right.
And then Gomes moved away. And then I just called Bill in there. And he started up. That was it.
Was that the Chicago Flying Saucer Band? Is that what that was
called? No, it was actually the L.A. Midnight Groove.
Oh, that's right.
Then we changed the name to the first record's called the Flying Saucer Band.
Mm-hmm. And that was 81 or something, or was
no,
that
no, that's
that
seven,
was in the 70s?
79.
Okay, 79. Okay, that's when you guys kind of went out and just did your own thing for a while, and you ended up with Musselwhite for a year. Yeah.
Yep. Here's a highlight of that tour. We're playing the Bottom Line, and there's Doc Pomus in a wheelchair sitting in front of me. And I went, this guy wrote million sellers, man.
Yeah, Lonely Avenue, and yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Didn't he write some Elvis songs? He wrote Little Sister and
bunch of songs, man.
So let me ask you this. Why do you think you ended up with so many harmonica players? Was it just something about the way you played guitar behind them that they...
I think I was, you know, the thing about me, when I, like I was telling you about learning all rubber soul and everything, I figured out chords first. Most guitar players don't. They want to learn leads first, right?
Right.
So I think that's the thing. My whole salvation is playing a bunch of chords.
Right.
And I just never concentrated on solos.
Yeah.
You know, until I watched everybody else and I got figure out, I can do that too.
And then when you heard guys like Robert Jr. Lockwood, you could see how harmonica players would dig that.
Exactly.
A guy that was able to play support to the harmonica.
Plus the fact, you know, talking to Shaky Jake, he said that Walter was a hell of a guitar player for everything, and he told a lot of those guys what to play, too.
Interesting.
And he said, here's the amazing, I got this on tape. He would adjust the amp.
Walter would?
While Lockwood was playing, he put more bass on it.
What a trip.
Because he goes, one guy, because I asked Jake, I go, did Leonard Chess give him that sound, or did they have the sound live? He goes, oh, they had the sound live.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
He goes, Tucker played treble,
right,
and Lockwood played bass.
Yeah,
they never hardly ever switched up because Tucker only played trebling.
Yeah, because I asked Jimmy Rogers one time. I go, how much of what you guys did in the studio? How much of that was Leonard Chess, and how much was you guys? He goes, it was all us.
That's right.
He goes, we had our sound in the studio. Leonard just told us when to start and when to stop, and that was it.
And that was Shaky's big deal. He goes, let's play quiet. Because Rod started getting loud, but he'd always go like this, man.
Well, I remember when I first saw you guys play down. I went to a gig, I remember one time in
Avila Beach.
Avila Beach.
Yeah, that's
right. I saw you guys at that place on the pier.
Oh, shit, yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
I got a photo of you guys playing it. And I remember you guys had the smallest little amps.
That was a good
and
one.
I was so impressed that you guys
greatest,
played at such a low volume.
That's the way those guys played.
Yeah. Really? And it is how they played, yeah.
You figure 1952 when they did Juke, there was no big amps.
No. Period. No way.
And I remember the Living Blues, they had the article on, I think it was Lewis Myers and Walter talking.
Right.
And he says, because everybody tried to figure out what is the amp they're using and all this stuff.
He goes,
yeah, I remember he had this old amp, man. It kept messing up, making a bunch of noise. He goes, what was it? He goes, International. That's a tractor.
It was a National.
I know.
That's what it was.
But he said it was two pieces, I had to be like a Commando or something.
Yeah,
who knows?
Exactly.
What?
Yeah.
So
it was like a PA system. That's what Dave Myers told me. He had like these columns that he would set in the club. And he said they had little 8-inch or 6-inch speakers, and he would set them all through the club, like four of them.
Actually, Jake said a lot of clubs had built-in speakers in the wall.
True.
Metal ones. And he said,
right.
And Walter noticed that, they'd have the Masco PA up there. And he goes, when he was in the audience while the band was playing before he got up there, he goes, you could hear the vocals coming out of everywhere.
Yeah,
That's when he started playing through the mic.
Wow.
Because the harp was everywhere.
Sure, it would be everywhere.
I go, were you in there when this was going on? And Jake goes, you could hear it. I mean, it sounded amazing.
That's what I heard, yeah.
It had that three-dimensional thing going. Where you hear it coming off the stage and right next to you.
Right. Right.
That must have been
pretty
something.
Amazing, yeah. And the funny thing is, I always heard Walter played through all kinds of different gear.
I got to tell this story.
Okay.
This has nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
I just thought of this, and it's a good one. So I asked Jake, I go, when's the first time you saw Howlin' Wolf? He goes, 1948 in West Memphis, Arkansas. And I go, what was it like? He goes, well, first of all, they had circus banners with Howlin' Wolf, with a man's body with like a wolf head with like fangs. And stuff on these posters, and everybody goes, he goes, black people are superstitious. He goes, and everybody, they kept playing, bombarding the radio shows with nothing but wolf songs, right? And everybody kind of got scared to come down there, right? So they paid their 35 cents to get in, and the curtains were closed. And when the curtains opened up, the band starts going ding dong, and he's in a cage with a big padlock on the front of it, and he's going like this. He's going like this, right? And the cage, the padlock's rattling like that, and everybody's eyes are all bugged out. Jake's going like this. He goes, they're going like this. And he goes, they started throwing pennies, nickels, and dimes and shit. And all of a sudden, it had a trap door in the back of it. So he just pushed it down like this, and two guys just carried that thing away, and the show started.
How wild.
I go, that's really, he goes, all that's gone. And, George used to talk about, up in Bend, Oregon, after the shows, he had like 5-6 drinks. He'd tell these stories, right?
He
says, everybody had a show back then.
Yeah, yeah.
He goes, that's the thing. That's what's missing now about this. That's what kind of upset him.
Interesting.
He goes, because even a guy like J.B. Lenore, man, he'd play behind his head and between his legs and shit, because everybody tried to compete with each other.
Right.
But it was a show.
Yeah.
And it was entertainment.
Yeah.
He goes, entertainment is lost in blues at that time.
Yeah.
That's what he said.
I believe that, yeah.
True.
Well, they definitely had like the head cutting contests and stuff.
Yeah,
there
was
a lot of that
going on all the time.
So that's another guy I wanted to ask you about is working with George Smith, because I know you and Rod did a ton of shows with George.
A lot of shows.
Yeah. And what were some of the highlights of working with him?
Well, the best one we ever did with him, where I really saw him at his peak performance, was at a ghetto club in Santa Barbara, believe it or not. And there's a shoe shine parlor thing and a rib joint in the front with funny lettering on it and this black club. And this lady ran it. So here was the show. Mighty Flyers, George, Pee-wee, Johnny Dyer, Shaky Jake. So first was Shaky, and he does long distance call, and he starts running around the mic this way. And she went like this, and then he starts going, and he starts getting dizzy, and he starts grabbing the microphone, almost falls over. So the next is Pee-wee,
right?
And they're vying for this woman behind the bar, so everybody's right, really shooting their shot.
All right.
So Pee-wee does the splits, and he can't get up. So he's stretched out like this, and he goes, "Hey, Johnny, get me up!" Johnny comes up there and gets him on his feet. But
that's George, like a James Brown.
And then who was after that? George. Never saw George do this. I'm going to take my hat off for a second to do this one. So the girl by this point, because it started getting good to her, she was like sitting in the first row.
Right.
So George does a somersault over to her with a mic, and he's got the chromatic. So he's right in front of her, and he goes like this. He grabs his hair, and he just goes like this. And his forehead just looked like an accordion. And the girl, and he's over there. I'm trying to play, but I'm trying to watch it too. And the girl's just going, so he started buying her salty dogs. He bought her 14 of them, right? So his room was right next to mine when the show was over.
Uh-huh.
And the doors cracked like that. And I go, "Hey, George." And he's got his underwear on. He's got his nylon socks going with like suspender hooks right. on them. Right? And he's got his black nylon shirt on. He goes, "Mike, I bought that damn woman 14 salty dogs and she jilted me." I go, "Hey, man, you win some and you lose some, George.
But at least you got to see that." That is great. Yeah. You ever see Cotton do a somersault?
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah.
I never got to see that.
He was skinny then, too.
Right, right.
That was a hell of a band.
Sure was. Oh, yeah. Tell me some stories about Pee-wee, too.
Well,
I saw Pee-wee, the best night I ever saw him was on one of your, you and Rod's gigs.
Man, I played so many times with him.
He really played great the night I saw him.
He was amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you how I met him. So we were doing a show at the, what's the name of that famous jazz club in Hermosa Beach? The Lighthouse.
Oh, the Lighthouse, yeah.
So it was a big blues festival. It was a two-day event. And I have a poster somewhere of it. And I can't remember all the people, but Johnny Hartsman was definitely there because he begged me to join his band. And I go, "What am I going to do? I'm in this band." He goes, right. He goes, "Hell with them. Come with me." And I go, "I can't do it." So we're backing up. We're going to do like four songs with Smokey Wilson.
Right.
So we did a sound check, and then we went across the street to eat. So I had a brown Vibrolux sitting on a milk crate and a reverb tank. When I come back, my stuff's moved out of the way, and all of a sudden, this half-stacked Marshall's there, and I'm going, "What the hell?" So I don't say nothing to anybody. I just move it back against the wall, and all of a sudden, this little short guy comes running past me and goes, "Rod! This damn guitar player just moved my amp." And Rod goes, "How's this young man going to play his show with your big-ass amp in the way, Pee-wee?" And I go, "Pee-wee Creighton."
Wow.
Well, there's a hell of a way to meet a guy.
Yeah, no kidding, yeah.
So anyway, what happened? This is the end of it. So we play the set, and I didn't even know George was in the place, period, because it's so dark in there, and you're playing right to the bar. So Rod walks out into the audience and hands the mic to George. And I went, "Oh, my God, George." And he starts coming up. Well, Pee-wee was sitting in front of me. He's drinking, smoking, and chewing gum. So he's watching us. He's going like. And all of a sudden, he sees George. And his Les Paul was leaning up against that half-stack Marshall.
Right.
So when George comes up there, he stops the band and goes, "Da da 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 da," and he starts going. And all of a sudden, Pee-wee runs and grabs his guitar, almost knocks me over, and he hits this G. It was in G, I remember that, because I look back and Pee-wee just goes, "Bing!" loud as hell. And I just went back and turned his amp down to our volume. So once again, as soon as that thing's over with, he goes right past me. Goes, "Rod, this damn guitar player turned my amp down." I go, "Hey, man, how are we gonna? You're gonna come out with your orchestra and back up Joe Turner?"
Right, right.
So that crazy. That's how I met Pee-wee.
I'm talking with Junior Watson a little more about guitar players. Like you just mentioned to me about playing side to side with Luther Tucker and how you couldn't really play any of his stuff when you're.
Well, I just felt, you know, it's just not kosher really.
Right, right, exactly.
Plus the fact that I respect the guy, you know, and I just, you know.
Yeah.
but it was kind of stifling because I was just, I've learned a lot of his stuff.
You did, yeah, yeah.
And you just don't do that kind of thing.
Right, right. You did so many sessions with so many great people over the years. Didn't you do a Johnny Dyer record?
Yep.
Aren't you on some of that?
Yep. Yeah.
And then the George Smith album, which I love.
Yeah.
And then
Boogieing with George.
Yeah, Boogieing with George. And then the other one is the Jimmy Rogers record.
I got to tell you a funny one on that.
Yeah, go ahead.
That was the Ted Brinson studio. That's where the Hollywood Fats Band did their record. It took them a year to make that record. You know?
Wow.
But I got to talk about the Jimmy Rogers
yeah.
record.
Right.
The Jimmy Rogers, that was done in 83.
Right.
And I go, the Jimmy Rogers? Because you never know, man. Let's go. And he goes, yeah. And he showed up. And from the minute he walked in, it was the most relaxed session I've ever been on in my life. The Rod Godmo bassman to play through, you know, he had that 335 or whatever it was he had. And we adjusted the amp, you know, and he just go, key of A. And we just started. And it was just one of those magical deals. It was, you know, I just tried to stay out of his way, you know, but we got a lot of intertwining stuff going on there. And then eventually, you know, he was drinking a little bit, you know, as it went on. And then finally he just goes, he just sets the guitar down. He goes, you got it from here on out. And I go, really? I go, what's this thing that you're going to do? He's going to do, what is the name of it? Slick Chick.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
I go, how's it go? And he says something or another, and I go, hey, Willie Schwartz, I go, you know that song Keep Pleasing Me by Nappy Brown? I go, do that drum fill in the middle of this thing. And so we do it. And he's looking over, and he's smiling at me, and I go, this is great. The guy's happy.
Yeah.
And then he started telling stories. Let me tell the story at the end of this thing. So Honey goes like this. She says, you know that picture? It's on calendars and stuff where you guys are picking cotton. Is that real? And Jimmy Rogers goes, well, yeah. She goes, I thought it was staged. She goes, no. We used to go a lot. If everybody was off on a Sunday, we'd go out there because we could make it like $1 an hour and just tell stories.
Wow.
That was the best times we all had together because everybody would just tell stories.
So he was saying that basically they would just stop by the side of the road and
no, they had places to go. They knew people.
So they knew who they could go pick cotton for.
And they just do it just to get away from their wives and tell stories.
Wow. This was before they were in Chicago?
No, it's in Chicago.
In Chicago. When they'd go down south and tour.
Exactly.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Wild.
Yep. Because you see a bunch of different guys. There's two or three of those pictures with different guys in them.
Well, I've seen the one that's got like Wolf and Cotton and Lil Walter and...
One of them has Sonny Boy in it, too, I'm pretty sure.
God, I don't know.
We did a lot of shows with Jimmy Witherspoon with Tucker.
Oh, okay, wow.
We'd open up.
Wow.
And that was a lot of fun, too, hanging out with all those guys and talking to them.
So would Tucker back up Spoon?
No, he'd play with us.
Oh, he'd play with you guys. Okay.
Robin Ford was in that band.
Right,
oh,
that's right.
Oh, I gotta tell you, I better not.
No, go ahead.
I know, I could really get in trouble on this one.
Really?
Yeah, you don't want to
change the names.
I don't want to say it. I better not.
Okay, we'll save that for the archives, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Oh,
Thank you.